Thank you for helping us make budget again last year. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for almost 6 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, and thanks for your financial support. Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the world, issues, etc., and sacred music for the world, LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're looking forward to partnering with you in 2014. Well, you walk into a church, and when you walk in, what you see often not only gives your first impression of what this is all about. What is this place all about? What is going on here? What is supposed to happen here? When you walk in, sometimes what you see will actually confess something to you. It will say something to you. You know, we talk in Christian terms about a confession of faith. Is our church architecture, can it be, for good or for ill, part of that confession of faith? Joining us to talk about church architecture on this Monday afternoon, January the 13th, Chad Bird. He's a hymn writer in San Antonio, Texas, and author of an article in the latest Higher Things magazine titled, Your Church is Too Sexy, Church Architecture Matters. Chad, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be here.
You say that sometimes when you walk into a church, what you see is indeed what you get. What do you mean by that?
You can tell a lot by your initial impression of a church's architecture, what you see as far as its sacred furnishings, or perhaps what you don't see as far as its architecture and sacred furnishings. Theology is reflected in a lot of different ways within a church, everything from its books where it lays out its confessions to its preaching to its hymns. But it's also reflected in the way that a church is built, how it looks, the furnishings that it has, everything about the way that it presents itself to the eye tells us a lot about what the ear is going to hear once the service begins and the songs are sung and the sermon is preached.
Now, I think probably in the broad swath of church history, there's certainly been variety in how churches have been built and appointed. But in the 21st century, that variety has turned into kind of opposite extremes. You give two very opposite extremes in the article that you wrote. One being a bone church. And the other one is the largest mega church in the United States, Lakewood in Houston, Texas, Joel Osteen's church. Talk about those two, if you would.
Yeah, the first one that you mentioned, usually called the Bone Church, is located in the Czech Republic, a few miles from the capital. The short story is that in the 19th century, an artist began to gather up these tens of thousands of human bones, and he was commissioned to make all of these into various churchly furnishings. Everything from chalices to chandeliers to just about everything that you can imagine that you would find inside a church. And he built this church, he furnished it, and it's made out of every single bone in the human body. Thus, of course, it's appropriately named the Bone Church. The opposite extreme that you mentioned, the Church of Joel Osteen, is very indicative of where that church is as far as the way that it presents itself to the worshipers and to the world. It's a transformed basketball stadium. They have these fake waterfalls at the front that can be controlled automatically. They have, of course, all of the lights and all of the gadgets that most mega churches do have in order to wow the audience, to present to those who are gathered there a performance, which is entertaining as well as, they would say, spiritually uplifting. But it has to have that whole wow effect, the whole entertainment, really for them to accomplish what they're setting out to do.
So kind of contrasting what each one of those says, what each one of those confesses. You walk into the Bone Church in the Czech Republic. What, among other things, is being said by that architecture?
One of the things that I said in an article that I wrote is that the verse that immediately came to my mind when I first learned about this church is the verse from Hebrews chapter 12, which talks about how we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. And you can't miss that in the church like the Bone Church, because all around you are the visible remains of saints, Christians who once worshiped in this church, or at least in this area. And they, when they were alive in the body, confessed the truth, they received the sacraments, they came to their end just like we all will, but their bones have remained. And they are scattered throughout this church, artistically arranged throughout this church. So there's no missing the fact that we're not just there as Christians who remain on earth, but indeed we are there surrounded by the church in heaven as well. So that when we gather there in the divine service, not just in the Bone Church, but any church, we are surrounded by those who have gone before us, who are with Christ, because we have come to Christ and he is with his saints, whether they are alive in the body or have departed and are with him in heaven.
And when you walk into Lakewood in Houston, Texas, that converted basketball stadium, what does that architecture, those appointments, what did they say?
There's very much a focus in that particular church, and in a lot of churches like that, upon not Christ. You're not going to find a cross there for sure. In my research, there's not a single cross within that whole sanctuary, and that was very much a purposeful decision, because the cross, they think, is an impediment, a stumbling block, which, in fact, it is. We can talk about that later if you want to. But there's no crosses. There's no altar. There's none of the furnishing that you would really expect to find in a Christian church, furnishings which aren't just there to be there or which serve some practical purpose, but which actually communicate what the church is, that it's the assembly of believers who are baptized, who hear the word, and who receive the sacraments. In the church in Lakewood, it's really a focus upon the preacher or the choir or whoever it is that is at that moment supposed to be the center of attention. That's what all of the lights serve to focus. That's what the very layout of the whole stadium is focused upon, is whoever is center stage at the particular moment. But it's very much of a performance-oriented church where the audience is there to be performed to, there to be entertained, instead of there to hear and to respond, to receive and to confess the truth that Christ is present among them with his gifts.
Does that play itself out? I mean, is it any coincidence that if you attend Lakewood, say, you know, a dozen times a year, you might, or more likely might not, even hear anything about Jesus Christ and him crucified, except maybe in a sinner's prayer at the end of the sermon?
Likely that would be the case. The architecture of Lakewood indicates their theology. All of this was done with foresight, with planning, so that the church would, the layout of the church, the way it looks, would communicate what the church verbally communicates as well. And unfortunately, the communication of Osteen and his preaching and his books and the worship service is, not only is it not Christ-centered, it's not even, Christ is really not even so much in the picture. That's the sad thing. I mean, there's lots of churches which may not be Christ-centered, but at least you're going to hear the gospel on occasion. I don't know that you would ever hear the gospel, or if you did, it would just be maybe hinted at in a church like that. And that absence of the gospel, the absence of Christ, the absence of baptism and the Lord's Supper, all of these absences are absent also in the architecture of the church. And so you have this bankruptcy all the way from what is taught to what is built.
Now, I attended one Sunday several years ago, a service at Lakewood on one of their Sunday morning services. And walking into that big open space there that is their, they would call it their worship center, their worship space. Here was my first impression. I wonder what your thoughts on it are, Chad. I walked in. The first thing that struck me was, how are they going to fill this thing up? We were there early. And by golly, by the time the service was halfway over, it was full of people. And that's the impression that struck me sitting on the floor there is, there are a lot of people here. A lot of people here. And of course, there was the spectacle at the one end of the stadium too, but you're kind of stunned by the mass of humanity that you find there. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, they do fill it. It's a 16,000-seat facility, and from what I understand, it is full or nearly full almost every Sunday. And honestly, it's really not surprising. What churches like that have done is they have really tapped into what people, or at least a lot of people, want to hear. It's a message of ethical or moral or practical advice or kind of rudimentary psychology that has a thin veneer of spirituality over it. People are always looking for ways to improve themselves, to get better at this or that, and to be happier, to have better relationships. All of those things are important to people. And what Osteen does is he addresses those concerns, and he would probably be a very good motivational speaker or psychologist or counselor, whatever you want to call him, if he would just do that. But instead, he presents all of this to people as if it's what Christianity is, and that's not what Christianity is. Christianity is all about Christ, and if it's not, then it's a false confession. It's not Christianity at all. But that's why I think he draws so many people. You have the excitement of that many people. I mean, it's got to be good, right? If that many people are coming, that's kind of the mentality. And then he addresses their perceived needs or their felt needs or their family problems, whatever it might be, in such a way that people think that they are actually getting religious advice or Christian advice, whereas they're not. They're getting a church that is only pretending to be a church.
Chad Bird is our guest. He's a hymn writer in San Antonio, Texas. When we come back, we'll come back to that subject of the cross or the crucifix as a scandal. Stay tuned.
Greetings from your friends at Zion Lutheran Church, Muscoota, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues, Etc. Zion Lutheran is a welcoming, family-friendly church that's firmly grounded on the unchanging truth of God's Word. We receive God's gifts of grace in a timeless, reverent way each Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Zion Lutheran is located at 101 South Railway in Muscoota, Illinois. Zion Lutheran is a church home that's both faithful and friendly, and you'll be warmly welcomed. For more information, call 618-566-7345.
In Higher Things, we believe that if you put good Christ crucified for you Lutheranism into a youth, you'll get a good Christ crucified for you Lutheran youth. Join us this July at the Higher Things Crucified Youth Conferences in Florida, Wisconsin, Utah. Check us out at www.higherthings.org. Higherthings.org. Dare your youth to be Lutherans this summer.
Sacramental, historical, liturgical. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. The Lutheran Church of the Good Shepherd in Greenville, South Carolina. St. Paul Lutheran, Chatfield, Minnesota. St. John Lutheran, Napoleon, Ohio. First Lutheran, Lufkin, Texas. Concordia Lutheran, Sykeston, Missouri. Hope Lutheran, Granite City, Illinois, Trinity Lutheran, Gladson, Alabama, and Lord of Life Lutheran, Chesterfield, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget.
Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday, January the 13th. We're talking church architecture and what it confesses. Chad Bird is our guest, a hymn writer in San Antonio, Texas, and author of an article in the latest Higher Things magazine titled, Your Church is Too Sexy, Church Architecture Matters. Chad, you mentioned before that the cross or the crucifix in particular is viewed by many who dumb down church architecture as an impediment, as a scandal, and you say, yes, it is. What do you mean?
Paul calls it a stumbling block, how the cross, the preaching of Christ crucified is a stumbling block to the Gentiles, it's a stumbling block to Jews, it's a stumbling block to all of us, because the message that the cross communicates is that God has done for us what we could never do for ourselves. He's taken on our sin. He's borne it. He's paid for it. And he's done this in a way that is contrary to everything we would expect from God. God is always working the opposite of what we think he should, what we expect he should. And so he dies a horrific death, this public execution. And in so doing, he pays for our sins so that it's no longer upon us, it was upon Christ. The problem that we have is that, of course, as sinners, we want to contribute something. So that's the first problem. But the cross tells us that it has all been done by grace for us. And the cross, because it is a symbol that is really revolting, we rebel against that because we don't think that that would be worthy of God. But instead, what we see here is a God who is willing to do that which must be done in order to save us, to even humble himself to the point of death, even death on a cross, in order to have us rather than to lose us eternally.
So when a church, in ancient times when a church was built, sometimes they had to make do with the space they had. That would have been very, very early Christians, but they were still mindful of whatever space they were using, confessing Christ and him crucified, weren't they, Chad?
Yeah, they were. There are always, of course, practical concerns and financial concerns when it comes to building a church or to providing its sacred furnishings, and there's room for creativity. That's why no two churches are exactly the same. But the decisions that a church makes as to whether it's a very small, simple church or whether it's a large, elaborate cathedral, wherever it falls within that spectrum, the question that the church needs to be asking itself is first of all, not how much money we have or what practical things that we need in the church. The first question that a church needs to ask itself is, what do we believe? What do we confess? And that has to be the driving force behind the decisions that they make. Because the church, the way it's set up architecturally, is going to communicate that confession to those who are there every Sunday or to people who happen to visit. So that the theology of the church, the confession of the church, is expressed architecturally to the eye, just like the confession is presented to the ear.
When a church says, and I've actually recently heard about one that they had a pretty decent architectural setup in their previous church building, and then they moved to a bigger one, and they consciously made the church what they called multi-purpose, which meant as plain as possible. And what it ended up looking like was kind of a glorified gymnasium with a stage at one end. What does that say when a church says, you know, we got to be multi-purpose. We can't just have this space that is dedicated entirely for preaching and the sacraments.
what it says to me is that they have the priorities reversed, and practicality has come to mean more than theology. There's a certain burden that a church needs to be ready and willing to bear when it comes to the way that church is architecturally. I think of the Israelites in the wilderness. They had to haul around this tabernacle with all of its furnishings, most of which were very cumbersome. They had to put it up and take it down and move every time that God wanted them to move. This was not a practical tent whatsoever in which God's throne room was located and his mercy seat and the table of showbread, all of those various furnishings. It was not a practical tent, but this was exactly the way that God told them that he wanted his sanctuary to be like, what he wanted it to look like, what he wanted it to contain. So the way that God wanted things to be was the way that it had to be. It wasn't a practical decision. And I think what churches need to ask themselves is, are we looking out for theology, or are we looking out for just kind of what works, something that's going to be multi-purpose? Yes, it might mean surrendering some things that we want, practically speaking, but it's worth it, because ultimately what is most important about a church is it's not as its fellowship center or its Bible classrooms or its gymnasium or any of that, but where the church is church, where the church gathers around Christ and his word and his sacraments and the divine service.
That ancient tabernacle, that ancient sanctuary that you mentioned just now, Chad, what did it confess? What was its architecture screaming at the top of its lungs? And should the church build its churches, its church buildings, to boldly, loudly scream the same thing to everybody who walks in?
I think the best answer to that is found in Isaiah chapter 6, where the angels sing, "Holy, holy, holy." That is what the temple as well as the sanctuary confessed. And by that I mean that here was the holy God in his holy space doing holy things, all for the benefit of his people. It was the holy God. The holy God was there within this inner sanctum, his holy of holies, enthroned between the cherubim. So they knew where God was located for them. He was omnipresent, of course. He was everywhere, but he had chosen to locate himself there so that they knew where they could approach him. And he had set aside this sacred space because it was here that his people could know that they were on holy ground because they were in the presence of a holy God. And that's where God did holy things. He gave his gifts and the sacrifices. He received their prayer and praising. He provided cleansing and righteousness and atonement, all of these gifts. So if you think about that in relationship to the Christian church today, we should expect the same. Would that when worshipers walk into any church, they say, "Holy, holy, holy," that they immediately recognize and verbally confess that this is holy ground where the thrice holy God has located himself to do holy things for his people. That when they see that altar or that pulpit, they know that this is where God is at work. This is where he's feeding his people. This is where he's speaking to his people. And that the space that they're standing on isn't for basketballs or for doing whatever activity the church might do outside of worship, but instead, this is sacred space for sacred things, for the sacred activities of God for his people. And I think that's the primary message that the tabernacle sends to us.
Before we let you go, tell us about your new book, The Infant Priest, Hymns and Poems.
Sure. It's a collection of approximately 20 hymns and around 80 poems that I've written over the course of the last 10 to 12 years. I have a couple of hymns in the Lutheran Service Book, and there are some other hymns that I've had published here and there, and I've gathered all of those together along with some other ones. And then I have about 80 poems on various topics, everything from various events in the life of Christ, various people in the Old Testament and what they were involved in. And then also have poems about the struggles of the Christian life, bearing the cross, struggling with doubt, depression, and all of these things that that we have to go through in this sinful world. And these, I hope, will give voice to the struggles that people face and help them to speak to God about them honestly and truthfully.
Folks, you can find out more about the Infant Priest Hymns and Poems by Chad Bird at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Chad Bird is a hymn writer in San Antonio, Texas, author of an article for the latest Higher Things magazine titled "Your Church is Too Sexy, Church Architecture Matters." Chad, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're very welcome, Todd. Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
When we come back, it'll be Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. this Monday afternoon, January the 13th. We'll be Pastor Tom Baker alongside, teaching a Sunday school lesson. Today we'll be in Matthew and in John, the early chapters of both of those Gospels, talking about John the Baptist preparing the way. That's Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.